This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to another packed Radio EcoShock show. I'm your tour guide, Alex Smith. This week, we look into why the U.S. government and governments around the world continue to kid themselves about the power of methane, the number two global warming gas in the atmosphere. With a threat this serious, coming from the melting Arctic, warming oceans, fracking, agriculture, and all our natural gas use, we shouldn't say kidding, it is lying to ourselves at great cost. A group of esteemed scientists have written to top levels of American government calling for a change toward reality on methane. Then we'll investigate some of the costs of carbon pollution with seasoned journalist and author Mark Shapiro. His new book is called Carbon Shock. The show wraps up with a turn towards the spiritual, a kind of scientific change in our whole story. Andrew Beath is our guest. Onward and upward. While the world's focus is on carbon dioxide, a group of powerful scientists have written an urgent letter to the directors of five U.S. government agencies. More than 21 scientists wrote the letter on July 29, 2014. It's just now surfacing in public, brought to my attention by Paul Beckwith. The scientists worry the American government, like other governments around the world, is not paying attention to the big risks posed by methane. That's methane from the Arctic, as you've heard about on this program, but also methane from gas fracking and other sources. Robert Howarth warned us about the gas fracking part years ago. One of the lead agents behind this letter is Anna Moritz, known as Mickey. She's a legal fellow at the Center for Biological Diversity. Mickey Moritz, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
This letter is one of those rare, historic, and extraordinary warnings from scientists to top levels of government. How did it come about?
We've been concerned about methane for quite a while, and when we read the IPCC most recent assessment, that's the International Panel on Climate Change, and we saw that the methane global warming potentials had changed greatly from previous assessments, we started watching what government was doing, and we noticed that government was not responding to this latest report from top international climate scientists.
Well, it's always surprised me the impact of methane is generally measured over 100 years, while the gas doesn't stay in the atmosphere anywhere near that long. Why do governments continue to use an unreal measurement?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with historical practice. Carbon dioxide, which is the standard of one on which everything else is based, has a half lifetime in the atmosphere of about 100 years. So I think that was the starting point. But as the most recent IPCC assessment indicates, there really is no scientific basis for using 100 years. And in fact, as the scientists who wrote this letter all really strongly feel, we need to be thinking on shorter timelines because climate change is happening so rapidly. We have maybe a decade, maybe 20 years before we start facing some catastrophic consequences. So we need to think about how gases will affect our climate in that short-term time period.
How are methane levels measured in Europe? Do you know?
I believe that they also use a 100-year global warming potential, so it's still stuck in this long time scale thinking, but I'm not positive of that.
Okay, well, I'll check it out, and I'll put something in my blog about that. I'm seeing quite different measurements for methane in the short term. The current agreement seems to be about 86 times the amount that carbon dioxide would be, but other scientists say it could well be over 100 or maybe even 150 for a short time, just a couple of years. How can we set a standard for such a changeable gas?
Well, again, I think that there needs to be a consideration of the timeline over which you're interested in analyzing the gas. So if you're talking about what's going to happen in a decade, then you should be using about a 10-year global warming potential. But if you're saying what's going to happen in 20 years, what do we need to do in 20 years to stop the worst effects of climate change, then you would want to use the 20-year global warming potential.
I think the worry that's been expressed by a couple of scientists that I've talked to is that even if it only happens like you get a burst of warming for 2 or 3 years, that could tip the system into other changes that we haven't really looked at. So even a couple of years could be important if we got a burst of methane from some source.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm betting most Americans and perhaps even a few of my listeners do not realize methane is the second most powerful agent forcing climate change, topped only by carbon dioxide. Why has it been so ignored, do you think?
That is a really good question. I think, for one thing, it's really easy if we can get people behind one gas. So we all got focused on carbon dioxide to start with because it is the one that there's the most carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And I believe it really is changing now. People are beginning to realize that even though there is so much carbon dioxide, the immediate effects of climate change can only be addressed through short-lived pollutants, that is, greenhouse gases and other climate forcers that stay in the atmosphere for just a short time, maybe a decade, some like black carbon only for a week. And so if we can get our focus back to these climate pollutants that remain just a short time in the atmosphere, it's really important because this is the time that if we make a change in these pollutants, we can actually reduce warming within a time period to stop those worst climate consequences. So carbon dioxide has been important and continues to be for a long-term perspective. Over the long term, we need to stabilize climate change, and that's going to require, absolutely require, reduces in carbon dioxide. But if we wait for that long-term change, we may, in the meantime, as you just mentioned, cross over some critical tipping points. So we need to also think about the short term and what can we do with the short-lived climate pollutants. And I think this is part of the reason why the Obama administration did put out its methane strategy, realizing that there has to be some immediate action and immediate response.
Well, according to the EPA, 60% of methane comes directly from human activity, things like our meat industry, rice growing, and the newest addition, the gas fracking industry. If we are doing it, does that mean we have options to control methane levels?
Absolutely. And I started working on this back in, 2007. And the reason we were so excited about methane then was that it was a way to avoid catastrophic consequences in the Arctic, and it was easy to implement. So at the time, the U.S. was considering various climate legislation for carbon dioxide. And we were really pushing that methane would be a lot easier to deal with because, first of all, there are just a few industries. You named the main ones right there. It's not everybody in their cars. It's a few industries, and it's much easier to implement changes for an industry than it is for individual citizens. And second, because natural gas is primarily composed of methane, it's worth money. So saving methane in some form, whether you're capturing it or whether you're stopping it from leaking from your natural gas system, is actually either going to save you money or you can then sell it for energy and as a company make a little money. So there are many mitigation options that are actually either cost neutral and sometimes even a cost benefit to implement.
There's plenty of names of scientists that I recognize who signed on to this letter, people like Drew Schindel, Michael Mann, and Michael McCracken. And we also find Robert Howarth, J. David Hughes, and Anthony Engraffia, and I know them as almost campaigning scientists trying to awaken the public to greenhouse gas impacts of fracking. Is that a serious part of the methane problem now?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think natural gas and fracking together need to be reconsidered in light of what the most recent science says about the importance of methane pollution. Because we know that fracking actually releases more methane than conventional natural gas methods. So if we are underestimating methane, which we currently are, which the government and agencies are drastically underestimating, we are handicapping ourselves in assessing whether or not we should be moving forward with natural gas and moving forward with fracking. This is particularly important given that the EPA is currently considering its clean power plan for CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions from electricity sector in the United States. And one of the main things that EPA is looking at is replacing coal with natural gas, but we need to be assessing methane emissions from natural gas systems, including fracking, in order to properly estimate what is the benefit of this clean power plan. And this is particularly essential when we consider that if we take the wrong path now, it's going to be really hard to reverse this in the near future. So this is our moment. This is our time when if we take the right step and set ourselves on the right kind of energy structure as a nation, we can really either make a difference for the benefit of the country or to the detriment.
Well, there's another story happening here with methane, and that is in the Arctic where the levels are rising up there due to the extraordinary heat, and that's due to climate change. There's grave risks of melting clathrates, as cited by Dr. Shakova. Our recent guest, Paul Beckwith, talked about that, and other scientists with the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, known as AMIG. Did the scientists you worked with talk about the Arctic methane problem?
I know that they are all aware of it and very concerned about it. We did not discuss specifically how do we work the release of methane from the Arctic into this letter, but we certainly are all thinking about this, and not only the release of methane from permafrost or methane clathrates, but overall the loss of sea ice, the loss of Greenland's ice sheet. All of this is occurring because of that rapid heating in the Arctic. The Arctic is heating twice the rate as the rest of the world. So, again, what do we do? Well, we need to act quickly. And the only way that we can act quickly is to reduce the short-lived pollutants like methane and black carbon.
And you mentioned the change in the Arctic sea ice, and I noticed the letter does reference recent science from Jennifer Francis at Rutgers and echoed by the independent research from Potsdam Institute. They say the loss of Arctic sea ice may be driving the truly strange weather we've experienced in recent years here in North America, but also in the UK and the rest of Europe. Was there controversy about including that in this warning letter?
None of the scientists who signed on had any concern with including that.
Well, I think that says a lot, because those are some big names in climate science. I know the AMIC scientists have been complaining for years about using the outdated 100-year global warming potential. Is there some resistance to moving the standard to meet current science? And if so, where does that resistance come from?
I think there's a dual reason why it's very difficult to get movement from agencies or from the administration. The first is that the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, which is the agency that oversees our greenhouse gas inventory, uses IPCC standards for international reporting. So there's an agreed upon standard for all countries that are a party to the UNFCCC. And that is by default what EPA uses when it's reporting its greenhouse gas inventory for our nation. The problem is that this agreed-upon standard was agreed to in the 1990s. So science has changed dramatically since then. We have requested in this letter that EPA continue to use the international reporting standards for its international purposes, but to adopt a new value, the most recent value, the best-supported value for domestic purposes. And this isn't hard to do. EPA, and in fact, in its inventory, calculated methane using a couple of different methane global warming potential values, although it never used the most recent value. So it would be easy enough to do, but it's just a matter of getting this habit going for the agencies and telling them it's okay to use two different values, one internationally and one domestically. The other problem is that if we as a country decide to use the most updated value, it will appear that we have more greenhouse gas pollution. And so when we are trying to show that we're moving toward meeting our goal under the Copenhagen Accord, it's very difficult to do that if we recalculate correctly to show that we're actually emitting more greenhouse gas pollution than we previously calculated.
Well, it may be inconvenient, but I think the truth is the best way to go when we're dealing with climate change. You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, talking with Mickey Moritz from the Center for Biological Diversity. The topic is the world's number two climate change gas, methane, also known as natural gas. Mickey, paradoxically, we talked about the EPA. They're using a chart on their site saying methane emissions from the United States have actually gone down a little in the 12 years from 1990 to 2012, but they don't post more recent information, which could include fracking. And Radio EcoShock guest Scott Miller from Harvard was part of a group of scientists that found real methane emissions in the atmosphere are at least 50% greater than EPA calculations. I should explain the EPA used a ground-up figure trying to add up the gas wells, the wetlands, the cows. But these scientists flew in the air and measured what's really up there. It almost seems to me like the agency doesn't want to know or is stuck in the past, as you suggested. Can this letter give them a push in the right direction?
We certainly hope so. We have not heard any response, but we're hoping that the agencies that received the letter are really seriously considering all of the arguments that the scientists who signed on have made.
So you haven't had any official feedback or replies yet?
Not yet.
How difficult would it be to bring these methane standards? You've touched on that. What has to happen?
It would not be too difficult. It would take the agency deciding that this was going to be an updated value. They would probably need to do a rulemaking, as it's called, to publish what the new value would be and take input on that. But it's not tough to do. They do it all the time. In fact, just recently, the EPA released a rule for some fluorinated climate pollutants and used the most updated values from the most recent IPCC assessment. So we know that they're open to using these values in some cases, and we'd like them to do the same for methane.
How do you rate the chances the Obama administration will really act on methane before his term is up?
I think that there will be action in terms of trying to bring awareness about sources such as landfills and natural gas. How much is actually going to happen is a big question, and I think there's a pretty small chance that there will be actually a change in the global warming potential.
Well, maybe, I mean, you raised this issue of the obligations under Copenhagen and looking bad if we raise the standards. That's really important, and I hadn't thought about that. Is there going to be a follow-up by this group of scientists or by others to get the higher standard adopted internationally, say, at the 2015 climate talks?
We have not discussed that step. I think that the thought has been if we can lead as a nation by showing that we are willing as the U.S. to domestically analyze methane in the most appropriate way and to accurately reflect the climate impacts of methane, that the international community would follow, but that we need to act first to show them that we are willing to do this.
Well, no doubt it's been an education working with such an elite group of minds. What is your personal conclusion about the threat posed by methane? Do you think it's a maybe thing? Do you think it's happening already? Could it go really big? I know you're not a climate scientist, but what is your take home on this?
As I say, I've been working on this a long time, and they call me Mickey Methane Moritz at the center because I'm really strong on we've got to deal with methane, and it is critical because, as I say, this is our chance. It's a short-lived pollutant. There are mitigation options that are economical and feasible. This is a particularly important pollutant for us to deal with now, immediately, so that we stave off the worst of climate catastrophe.
We've been talking methane and the way governments operate with a blindfold using outdated measurements that underplay the danger of this powerful greenhouse gas. Our guest is a legal fellow for the Center for Biological Diversity based in Arizona, but we reached Anna Mickey Moritz in Washington State. You can find this important letter from 21 scientists at the website biologicaldiversity.org. I'll also put a link to it in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Please read the letter for yourself to find out what scientists are trying to tell the government. Mickey Moritz, thanks for your hard work on this over the years, and thanks for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
I was happy to be here. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Despite all the green hype, carbon emissions are rising and the increase is increasing. Face the facts, this is a human problem requiring human solutions, and if you don't like the idea of new taxes on carbon, our next guest says we are already paying plenty for climate change. As an experienced journalist, Mark Shapiro tackles the whole messy climate problem. His new book is Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy, and it sure is disrupted. Shapiro has appeared everywhere that intelligent reporting is allowed, like PBS specials and features in magazines like Harper's and the Atlantic Monthly. As an award-winning environmental journalist, one of his previous books was Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products. You're going to hear a lot about carbon shock this fall, so let's get in early on Radio EcoShock. Mark Shapiro, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, you say we're already paying a price for carbon. It's just that it's hidden. Can you explain that a little?
Yeah, I think that's the interesting way to begin to understand, actually, the choices that we face in moving forward, because often the dynamic is framed in such a way that we're going to have to pay X amount of money in order to invest in renewable technology and such, and that is going to be expensive. And number one, that is true. It's going to cost some level of investment in a green infrastructure to wean us away from fossil fuels. I think much less expensive than we think, but still it's going to cost something. So then it becomes this question. What are we already paying? And actually, when you look deeply at a whole array of phenomenon across the board in terms of the public expenditure today, when you look at the expenses for everything starting with like public health and the increase of public health costs as kind of formerly tropical diseases move into the United States, which is happening. When you look into the rising cost for sustaining the infrastructure across the United States to protect our coastlines. When you look across the board at the different challenges, when you look at the rising food costs and the challenge that farmers are facing, you know what one of the most expensive expenditures is for the United States government, now one of the most dramatically rising expenses, is crop insurance. Crop insurance is supported by the U.S. government here in the United States. And the areas most related to climate change when it comes to heat, when it comes to extreme weather, are the ones that have been rising most significantly in the crop insurance system. So my point is really to begin to make an honest assessment of what these expenditures are, to understand we are already spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to deal with the impacts of climate change. So first step, and this is what I write about in my book, is understanding what those costs are. Those costs have largely been hidden by an accounting system, which actually doesn't call them costs. When we purchase fossil fuels, when we purchase gasoline, when we purchase other forms of fossil fuels, the price that we're paying does not reflect those costs that we ultimately end up paying as members of society and as tax-paying parts of both the United States and Canada and every other country that's impacted.
Well, right. Lately, the TV news has a new feature I call weather porn. We watch city after city flooding out due to extreme rainfall events. And the general line is the victimized area got a month or more of rain in 24 hours. And it's just peculiar weather, you know, nothing to do with climate change, of course. And the drainage systems from a previous century can't cope with it. That means big spending for cities that are already broke. Is that a symptom of what you're writing about?
Well, yes, that is exactly the symptom. You put it very well, that in a way, as individuals living in wherever we might be, in this country, in Europe, in Africa, any continent on Earth, essentially, we experience the weather as individuals. You know, a huge rainstorm comes and we're like, oh my God, the streets are flooding, or it gets incredibly hot and we're suddenly subject to, you know, 90, 100 degree temperatures, you know, Fahrenheit, that are sweltering. And we experience those as individual moments of an extreme. What you need to begin doing is to actually start seeing across the board, when you see those phenomena in every corner of the earth, basically these extremes of temperature altering the conditions of life down here on earth, that's how we begin to understand what the impacts of climate change are. And so those kind of freak rainstorms that you're talking about are essentially not so freaky anymore. And I think that's what the climate science is telling us, is these events that used to be extreme, that used to happen in only under extraordinary circumstances once every 50 or 100 years, are now more and more the norm.
And we're seeing headlines saying the California drought is going to push up food prices, and they're already pretty high, I think. Do we have any indications or science that this California drought is related to climate change rather than being a cycle that appears every now and then?
Well, that's actually a very good question. And the science is very clear. And there are numerous scientific reports, which I cite in my book, all starting at the United Nations team of global scientists, all the way down to some of the most respected scholarly journals in the world, essentially are talking about this phenomenon converging for a number of different reasons. In fact, what's interesting when it comes to the California drought, there's not necessarily less objective water falling, right? In some cases, there are less objective numbers of water. But the biggest concern for the state is that because the atmosphere is warming, what used to fall as snow in the wintertime, right? So we're talking now about the months of, let's say, December to February. When it gets pretty cold, it's supposed to get pretty cold up in the mountains in California. Well, the snow would fall during the winter months and create essentially a solid reservoir of water. And later in the year, starting in, let's say, March to, you know, June, when the temperature starts heating up, that snow would melt. And as it melted, replenish basically the parts of the state that were very dry, right? So basically you have a whole channeling system to take that water when it starts to melt and bring it down to the southern parts of the state that are far more dry than the northern parts of the state. But what's happening now is that actually instead of snow falling in those winter months, what's happening is rain is falling. And less quantities of rain, but still rain does fall between those months of November and February. And the water system of California is not designed to use that massive quantity of water that's suddenly coming from the mountains, not as snow and sitting there, but it's actually running into the state water system. And that water system was designed essentially to handle water as it came kind of incrementally down from the mountains. Now it's being overwhelmed, and so you have a massive amount of water that's actually being, quote, wasted. Wasted in the sense of it's not being channeled properly to agriculture or to the southern cities because it's overwhelming the reservoir system. And that's one part of the phenomenon that is very clearly linked to climate change. And there's another aspect which I'd like to point out. I spent a lot of time in reporting this book in the Central Valley of California, which is one of the breadbaskets of the United States. I mean, they grow more fruits, vegetables, nuts than any other part of this country. Stress is appearing all over the place, and we're talking about in large farms. You know, these are big, big farms. And you see, for example, I learned a lot in doing this book. Let me tell you, I learned a lot about agriculture. And one thing I learned was that when it comes to very sensitive tree crops, most vividly with cherries, and I'm sure all of us, you've enjoyed a nice, juicy red cherry in the springtime. And California has long been one of the leading cherry producers in the United States, along with Washington and Oregon. Well, what has happened is that cherries, guess what? Cherries need, in the month of December, January, basically, in order to fully ripen, cherries need to get cold. They need to actually have a period of time, which they call chill hours, in which it gets very, very chilly, which enables the cherry to essentially hibernate. That's the wrong technical word, to essentially slow down its metabolic forces so that when it comes up in those beautiful, resplendent harvest season in the spring with all those beautiful buds and flowers and juicy red cherries, part of that comes because it's been able to reserve its own internal resources during that chill period in December, January. Well, that chill period, when it gets cold, when it's supposed to get cold, has been shrinking dramatically. And so what you found is a roughly 20% decline in the number of hours that are cold enough to enable the cherries to go into that chill period, which has meant that the cherries that are coming out in parts of the Central Valley in California, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley, are ending up smaller and stunted, and the trees are not delivering as much yield as they used to. And that, too, is a phenomenon of climate change. And this is backed up by numerous studies out of Stanford, different universities, they're all footnoted in my book. My book has extensive scientific footnotes to back up all these kind of ideas. I mean, this comes from the science. And what I try to do in my book was take the science. I read those scientific journals. I tried to understand what they were arguing. And then I went out into the fields, into the places where those phenomena that are being described by scientists are actually being experienced by people. And you really feel that most vividly when it comes to the sort of situation of farmers. And they'll all tell you that the weather is unlike any they've ever seen over the last 5 to 10 years.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is respected journalist Mark Shapiro, formerly a senior correspondent for the Center for Investigative Reporting and a teacher at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. We're visiting Mark's new book, Carbon Shock. There's several dodges that you go into the book. We can't really do much more here than list them due to time limitations, but you talk about embedded emissions into consumer products and about the whole aviation industry game. Talk to us about the airplanes. We pay more taxes to drive to work than we do to fly across the country?
Yes, that's really something I learned in the process of doing this book. When it comes to airplanes, you know, let's remember, airplanes use massive quantities of fuel. And one of the big issues now in the debate in the world is essentially how to account for the greenhouse gases that come out of the back of those airplanes, which actually even have more damage to the atmosphere because they're actually emitted in the atmosphere. And so there's been a hidden, kind of like very quiet but enormously significant battle that's been brewing between the European Union. The Europeans have passed a policy which requires that airplanes that fly in and out of Europe begin to pay a small price for the greenhouse gases that come out of the back of the airplanes. And every time you fly to Europe, whether you know it or not, the pilot is submitting a figure as to how much fuel he is using to the aviation authorities in Europe. and the greenhouse gases that come from the back of that plane. The United States has not liked that idea. The United States has objected strenuously to the European approach. And there is now a sort of a battle emerging, a diplomatic row, in which the United States, along with China and Russia, this is one area we're actually aligned with Russia very closely on, as well as other large developing countries, to try to block the European effort to have us pay for our aviation emissions. What's interesting about this battle, and I describe it in length, and it's very dramatic. I mean, it's actually, most people have no idea this is happening, but there's enormous amount happening behind the scenes diplomatically, with a lot of leverage being waged, and it's being called the first kind of trade war over climate change. One of the interesting things about that is, how do you go about regulating a transnational industry like aviation? And this is where climate change gets so interesting and provocative in terms of figuring our way forward, because it challenges traditional notions of national sovereignty. How do you regulate emissions that are literally pumped into the atmosphere across numerous national frontiers in an airplane? Well, this question is now being debated and is actually going to probably be resolved in the next year or two, and it's worth keeping an eye out on. And I go into some detail on this question.
Mark Shapiro, do you think anything substantive will happen at the 2015 climate talks?
The answer to that is yes. I actually have now been pretty deeply immersed in studying the economic questions surrounding climate change. And I think we need to acknowledge, as much disappointment as people might have in terms of the speed with which change is happening, that there is an enormous amount of attention now being given to how to begin trying to slow down the emissions from fossil fuels. And we've moved a long way from Copenhagen, which was in 2009 and widely perceived as, broadly speaking, a failure in terms of an international agreement. Now we have President Obama beginning to take some actions here in the United States, the Europeans moving forward, the Japanese, even the Chinese, and I write about this in my book, how the Chinese are beginning to actually take significant actions to deal with their greenhouse gas emissions. So I think 2015 is going to be a very critical year. The popular pressure from the citizens' movements, both in this country and abroad, is intensifying. There's, of course, going to be large demonstrations worldwide at the end of September, third week of September, when there's going to be a big summit at the United Nations to begin laying the groundwork for an international agreement. So I'm hopeful that actually some kind of agreement is going to happen. Whether it's fast enough, I don't know. Whether it's aggressive enough is a question, but I'm pretty hopeful that things are going to begin to start moving forward.
Well, among the less hopeful, I had a guest, Dr. Tim Garrett. He's a scientist at the University of Utah. He published a peer-reviewed paper showing carbon emissions equal wealth. And so far, he says, only societies that experienced a significant collapse, like the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, have been able to reduce emissions on a scale that matters. That was 5% in their case. From your research in carbon shock, can we save ourselves without an economic collapse and a big retreat from consumer spending?
Well, that is an extremely good question. I think that, yes, the example, ironically enough, actually, the economic recession in Europe also meant, and in the United States, between 2008 to 2012, roughly, meant a decline in emissions. That is definitely not to argue for the benefits of economic recession. The question of how to get us to significant reductions, look, I think it's too easy to be apocalyptic about this. I don't think we're talking about the end of the world as we know it. I don't think we're talking about the collapse of civilization as we know it. I just want to make that clear. I'm not tending to apocalypse. I think that actually there are initiatives breaking out all over the world. Both here in my own state of California, we have a greenhouse gas law that's beginning slowly to shift public resources towards a greener energy grid. You have similar things afoot in New England. You have had in Canada, there was a bit of a retreat in Canada. There's also been a retreat in Australia. This is a very complicated question. So when we look at guideposts for success, I think we have to keep our eye on the large picture, which is that we have to do some dramatic shifting of the way we organize the energy grids all over the world. That needs to happen urgently. The enormity of the challenge is really about shifting the basis upon which we've had economic growth for the past 200 years in a very fundamental way. Basically, I agree with the conclusion of the scientists in Utah that you cite, that thus far we've seen significant emission declines during periods of economic recession. And that's both in Russia, the former Soviet Union. It also happens to be the case in the European Union and the United States during this period of our recession. In Russia, that was more in the early 90s. So the issue here is not to strive for an economic recession. The issue is to take the large amounts of public money that are now used to subsidize the fossil fuel industries. And we subsidize them in numerous ways. Number one, we give explicit subsidies still to the oil and gas industries. In the United States, roughly about $4 billion a year in explicit subsidies to those industries. One. Two, massive hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in monies that we are paying for the public health consequences, the infrastructure consequences, the consequence on our food system and numerous other elements to essentially subsidize the cost of fossil fuels. And this is the economic equation that has to change. We have to basically start taking that money, which we are already using to subsidize the fossil fuel companies, and shifting that in a more green direction. And I think that that's what's essential, is that people understand the economics of this decision. If they're worried about the amount of money involved in shifting us to a more green economy, they need to begin to understand how much money they're already spending to subsidize the very industries that have gotten us into this mess.
Another recent Radio EcoShock guest from the UK, George Marshall, said he's tired of seeing the same faces at every climate talk. And if we want to survive, he says, we need to take this thing out of the San Francisco Bay Area and into Texas, or wherever the equivalent conservative carbon zone is in Canada, the UK, or Australia. Can we get conservatives on board to fix climate change?
Well, it's interesting that you should put it that way. Number one, there's a growing movement, even among kind of economic conservatives, who actually see the benefits of a carbon tax. And what's interesting about that is these are people who actually are committed to the principles of the free market. And if you are committed to the principles of the free market, to the actual free market, then you, and what they're concerned is that the existing market basically unfairly tilts the playing field toward the fossil fuel industries, because it provides these numerous subsidies and ways for paying for fossil fuels that actually create an asymmetry in the market when it comes to actually making the choice over renewables versus fossil fuels. So one, George Mason University is one place where this is happening. George Mason as a kind of a conservative kind of think tank run by former Republican congressman from South Carolina that's been pushing for a carbon tax. Even some large companies have been pushing for a large multinational company has been pushing for a tax. Number one, because it also would create a sense of kind of a level playing field. So you don't have like one place like California that might be more extreme than Texas. And therefore, if you're a big multinational company, you don't want to deal with all these competing standards. So there's something to be said for that. At the same time, you have in literally Texas, for example, which you cite, is the leading user in this country of wind power. So of all the states in the country, of the United States, that uses wind power and relies most heavily on wind power for its electricity, that state is Texas. Obviously a very conservative state and far from the San Francisco Bay Area. And that's because of the economics of wind power. They have a lot of wind, and it definitely stacks up competitive-wise with the fossil fuels. So the point is to begin opening our eyes to where the potentials are for renewables, and they're all over the country and all over the world. I'm not sure this is any longer a question of a bunch of kind of emotional, whatever that caricature of the San Francisco Bay Area is, emotional nature lover, eco fanatics, however you want to characterize that. I think we are far, far, far beyond that caricature, because actions related to climate change are actually happening all over the world, including, by the way, in China. And I write about this in my book, that actually some of the most interesting initiatives related to climate change are happening in China, which is aggressively pursuing a kind of renewable energy development for its electrical grid, as well as exporting massive quantities of solar and wind technology. So we have to begin to look at these things differently, and I think that is a grotesque oversimplification to suggest that the primary energy on this question comes from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Well, no insult to San Francisco. I've got lots of great listeners there. Look, is there a website for this new book, Mark Shapiro, and how can people follow your work?
Yes, thank you. The book is available. It's in bookstores all over the country, I believe. It's also on your usual kind of online sales. I'm on Twitter. If you go to @Shapiro, and Shapiro, S-C-H-A-P-I-R-O, I'll be tweeting a lot, and I'll be blogging in different places, but I will kind of let you know via Twitter where those pieces will be showing up. I'll be writing a lot also in the run-up to the climate conference later in September.
This is Alex Smith saying we are in carbon shock, whether we admit it or not. Investigative journalist Mark Shapiro has laid out the facts, and he adds some excitement to the chase, I think, in his new book, Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy. It's just out from Chelsea Green Books. You can find more links in my weekly show blog, published at ecoshock.info. Mark, thanks for explaining some of the basic facts of carbon life.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
While most of Radio EcoShock is devoted to science, we all know there are deep movements within us that science can't really touch or fulfill. And our next guest has been a green activist for 30 years. He founded the environment group Earthways Foundation in California back in 1985. More recently, Andrew Beith has been considering our green needs for spirituality. For example, he's the author of the book Consciousness in Action, The Power of Beauty, Love, and Courage in a Violent Time. Now Andrew is publishing a trilogy of books which look at a new story of creation, one based on the amazing discoveries of science to be sure, but also new ways of looking at the world. So let's have a conversation with Andrew Beith. Andrew, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
How did you get started in the ecological movement, Andrew?
You know, I write about that in the first book, and it's about a personal transformation, which I think most of us have to go through to escape the very significant influences of enculturation. In my case, I was, you know, I went to a prep school. I went to one of the best colleges, Duke University. I went to graduate school at Wharton, at the University of Pennsylvania. I joined a corporate firm, but none of that was meaningful enough. So at about age 30, I dropped out. I took 10 years of traveling the world, learning to write poetry, and seeing, trying to develop a new worldview. So that by age 40, I came back into sort of the social stream, and that's when I began the nonprofit work and the activism.
So is the Earthways Foundation still going, and what does it do?
Yes, it's been going the entire time. We do projects, small projects usually, but things that exemplify or model the philosophy that we're talking about today. For example, in Central America and Guatemala, we've been working in a village for 15 years, just helping village women with various aspects of their life, how to store grain by building grain silos so they don't lose the yearly production to rodents and that sort of thing, new health criteria and new forms of cooking stoves so that they're more sustainable, more healthy, that sort of thing. In Los Angeles, we were a major group in the Biona wetlands fight, which the last remaining wetlands in Los Angeles County was being developed with 30,000 people, and we were able to knock that down to about half over 10 years and get the most delicate of that wetlands saved to a sustainable project doing well. Projects like that, we have about 12 projects. So we helped to start a group named Amazon Watch, which was part of Earthways when it started. It's now blossomed into its own very large, independent, active protector of the Amazon, much like Rainforest Action Network. And other groups have started with Earthways and then gone out on their own as independent groups.
What are social and environmental entrepreneurs? That's something else you founded.
Yeah, that's an organization that when Earthways does its own projects, and a lot of friends or other people that heard about Earthways were coming and saying, can you give us a temporary tax-exempt status so we can take in donations and then start our work. Well, we did that for a while, but it became very distracting, so I started a new organization called SEA, Social and Environmental Entrepreneurs, about 15 years ago. It's now grown into 80 different projects. So it's projects like the one I was describing where individuals have an idea that they want to pursue activism, usually social change, progressive social change, and we help them get started. We provide the tax status. We give them advice. We do all the accounting. We do all the interfacing with the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, and in the U.S., and with the CPAs that do the accounting and that sort of thing. We have 90 groups. It's $7 million a year in activity now, and it's growing very quickly.
You know, Andrew, when I consider the climate movement, it seems almost split into two camps. One is very science-oriented, and they almost take offense if you start talking about spirituality. And the other is spiritual, and science is kind of a sideline. Have you encountered this?
Well, activists are not easy to get along with in terms of, you know, the average population, because they are often very much concerned and angry over the circumstances that are destroying our surroundings. So it frequently leads to, you know, sort of a tough personality that's hard to get through to, and it's also not necessarily commensurate with a spiritual approach to life. So the Consciousness in Action, the first book that you referred to, is a way to try to encourage those people to integrate the sacred nature of life into their love for the planet or for the social concerns that they have.
You know, I know some people are going to laugh at this idea, but I wonder whether Gandhi or Nelson Mandela could ever get elected in the U.S. Could we ever see our way through to the day when an American president promises nonviolence and actual love towards the world and all the species?
Can't do it. You know, Jimmy Carter was like that, but he was afraid to use that language. I think Obama is like that, and he is only willing to, you know, use a particular way of speaking to the electorate. Why? Because you can't get elected that way. So these books, especially this new trilogy, the new creation story, it's about changing the world view. It's about changing society, and it's very hard to do that from the inside out. Obama's a perfect example. The most powerful person in the United States wants to make important changes for the environment and for peace and for relationship people to people, but it's very restricted in what he's able to accomplish. So how do we change that? Well, it's got to be a personal transformation that sees the world differently, a different attitude, a different worldview, a different way of relating to the earth and nature. Humans' relationship to the natural world needs to have new ways of being expressed so that the way we behave as a culture is able to be modified. It's a long process, and it's a person-to-person process, but it has started. I call it the Ecological Epoch. It's the title of the third book of the trilogy. The first book is called In the Beginning, and that takes us from the Big Bang to when humans became modern, Homo sapiens, which is 200,000 years ago. Second book is called Consciousness. It brings us from that beginning of modern human beings, the Homo sapien, to today. How consciousness, philosophy, and science developed up until the moment. The third book is called The Ecological Epoch, which shows us the ways that we've already learned to live and behave in ways that are sustainable and consistent with understanding the earth to be a sacred, a living system, that we, to benefit ourselves and add more meaning and joy to our own lives, as we deepen our understanding of what that's about, we are able to not only heal our own wounds, but heal the earth's wounds also. Now, there are millions and millions of people around the world that know this, but it's still a tiny fraction of the 7+ billion people, and we just need to build that movement into a larger accumulated group in order for the turning point to come into play and have that shift actually occur. I don't know if that's 10 million people needed, 100 million, but I know it's not half the people on the planet. I know it's a small percentage, maybe 2 or 3%, and that percentage is growing The issue is whether it can grow quickly enough that the destruction we're doing with our economy, our outlook toward the Earth as a resource and not a sacred space, whether that destruction will occur too quickly that we can gracefully transition. The ecological epoch is the 10th in a series of consciousness stages that Homo sapiens have gone through that I delineate from the beginning, from 200,000 years ago, the beginning of modern humans. And it's here to stay. It's not going away. It's brand new. It's a way of seeing the world. There are hundreds of books being written about it. But will it be integrated quickly enough to allow us to change gracefully? If it's not, the planet will make the change for us. That might mean that a significant percent of the human population alive today will not survive.
Yeah, our whole landscape is likely to change bit by bit. We have to adapt to extreme weather events, fires, floods, heat waves. You've seen it, some of that in California. And even the insects and plants are going to rearrange around us. It's going to destabilize us mentally and add a new kind of confusion. Could it also stimulate the new awareness and movements that you're looking for?
Well, that's a basic premise of the three books, the trilogy, that the destruction we've caused has been the catalyst for taking the next step in the evolution of human consciousness. So that's what the new creation story is. Now that we are able to see the planet differently, we see the living systems, we see how the interrelationships work, we see that everything is interdependent, and we're learning this because of the necessity of understanding the destruction that we've caused and how to fix it. So yes, it all is interrelated, and I don't know that the changes may seem gradual now, but remember, gradual, 100 years in geologic time is a blink of the eye. And so when you have we've never had 7 billion people before. We had 1 billion people in 1800. So anything that humans did to insult the Earth could be absorbed by the Earth. By the time 1945 rolled around, when I was born, we started exploding nuclear bombs, and our population had grown to 2.5 billion. Well, now it's 7+ billion, and that's too many people to be able to gradually adapt to major changes. For example, the rainfall will probably increase with global warming, but it will not fall on the agricultural lands where it's needed. Some of it will, and some of it won't. When we start having massive starvation, people aren't going to just stay where they are and die. They're going to get up and move, and they're going to move to their neighbor, and there's no room in neighboring countries. The planet is too full. So what's going to happen? Social chaos. So this is the non-graceful transition. We can do it gracefully. There's still time, but it means that we have to put a major focus on, especially on the global warming issue, the climate change issue. Otherwise, agricultural destabilization is the first stage, and we're beginning to see some of that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the seasoned environmentalist out of Los Angeles, Andrew Beith. We're talking about his new series, The New Creation Story. Andrew Beith, do you believe that Earth itself has a consciousness, which we could call Gaia?
Tricky question. I believe there is a disembodied consciousness that isn't about human beings, and that human beings tap into that consciousness in order to gain a deeper understanding of the nature of reality. So is that the Earth's consciousness? Is it the cosmos's consciousness? Is it the creative source's consciousness? Whatever you think of the creative source as being, there is consciousness that's not about human beings, yes. Is it only Gaia? Gaia is a living system, and all living things have consciousness. Humans happen to have self-reflective consciousness, so they think about consciousness and they write books. But that's all kinds of other beings have consciousness, and the Earth itself, there is an Earth consciousness along with a much larger gestalt of consciousness.
So we don't really know how human consciousness connects us or why sudden waves of thought pop up all over the world. The psychiatrist Carl Jung called it synchronicity. He's a favorite of mine. There are lots of people out there who hope, maybe they even pray, that a wave of awareness could spread rapidly across the globe and drive us towards action, not just on climate change, but our whole relationship to nature. Is that your hope, and is there any sign that it's coming?
Yes, that's the hope. And hope's a good word. Optimism is not such a good word. There aren't any signs that it's coming. The signs are that the business as usual, you know, corporate mentality and creating more stuff for more and more people and larger populations, especially like those of China that are just coming into wealth, is more likely to occur. However, magic does occur. So even though there's no rational way of thinking about the problem to believe that it will can be solved, there might be non-rational, magical interventions that can solve it. And I believe that the more people understand the human's relationship to nature and to Earth as a sacred relationship, the more likely that those magical interventions might occur.
Andrew, where are you in this project? Are all three books of the New Creation Story finished and out there?
Book one and two are available on Amazon and finished. Book three, I'm even today finishing the final edit, and it'll be available in about 30 days.
Okay, now how do you approach such a large topic? I mean, can we expect to find science fiction, stories from people you've met, or what?
No, it's scientifically based. Anthropology, quantum mechanics, psychology, Carl Jung you mentioned, major player, and it's got a sub-story, and the sub-story is the creation story. So we learn how the Earth was created, where life came from, the chemicals morphing into living things and becoming human eventually. We learn all that, but there's a sub-story that is the creation story, how humans are part of everything that has occurred since the Big Bang forward. So yeah, I reference lots of scientists and lots of philosophers. I don't use stories of people. I use my own story. The creation story is the story. And so the idea is that the stories we have, including the Bible, are useful to a point, but they don't take into account the circumstances and the challenges that we face. So the more we can create a story that is appropriate to our circumstance, the better we understand our condition or the human condition in life and our situation. The better we understand that, the more we're willing and able to face up to the challenges, the very difficult challenge of solving these problems that could sink the ship. I don't think humans are going to disappear, but things could get bad to the point that a large percentage of the human population could die off.
Can you give us a web page where people can go to find out about this series, and do you have a Facebook page where people can follow up with you?
You know, it's so new. These two books are only out a month. Yes, they have a website. The books have a website that can be accessed. It's called newcreationstory.com. So it's the title of the book without the T-H-E in front, newcreationstory.com. The books can be found on Amazon just by putting the title in or my name, Andrew Beath, B-E-A-T-H. And there is a Facebook page that the publicist is developing, and I don't know how to tell you how to reference that yet.
All right, well, we'll look for it in a little while. I'm sure we can just Google it. Is there any final message or thought you would like to leave with our listeners as we wrap up here, Andrew?
Well, I'd love people to check out the New Creation Story and start thinking about the world a little differently. You know, how does one's life relate to the Earth and nature and the beginning of time as a part of their own story? I think the biggest difficulty is our history, our written history, is so short compared to humans, even the 200,000-year modern human. We've only had writing and literature for a few thousand years, 3,500 years. So we need to look at the whole story behind that in order to understand who we are. When we understand who we are, we will influence our neighbors to behave differently, and that's the thing that will help make this change in a graceful way instead of a chaotic way.
Our guest is longtime environmental activist and author Andrew F. Beath. We've been talking about his trilogy, The New Creation Story, Spirit, Eros, and Climate Chaos. Find out more, as he says, at newcreationstory.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Once again, friends, we're totally out of time. Thank you for sticking with the program. Radio EcoShock is now broadcast on 87 nonprofit radio stations in the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and we can still say that, Australia, and now Paris, France. You make it all happen by passing on the tweets, Facebook links, emails, and word of mouth. Let's get that word out there. I'm Alex Smith, and I hope to get together again with you next week.